good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and if you're new to the show, I'm the author of the acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and what I like to call its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. And you were just listening to a snippet from Abigail Spinner McBride's cut, Arms of the Mother. Well, this week on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I'm thrilled to have two awesome guests for your listening pleasure who are certainly making a difference out there in the world. The first is the spiritual warrior and activist Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping and the Church of Earth Illusia. You might recognize him from the documentary What Would Jesus Buy? Reverend Billy says, we've been hypnotized and consumerized. We equate material goods with love, and if we could just change Christmas, well, we could change the rest of the year. Well, and then as my second guest, tonight I hope you'll stay tuned to hear Professor Gina Messina Dysart discussing the Feminism and Religion Project and her forthcoming book, Rape Culture and Spiritual Violence. But first, a few housekeeping tidbits. I have to ask, do you want to be a fly in the ointment of patriarchy? If so, well, I hope you'll join us in our Sacred Sunday services, the fourth Sunday of every month at the Green Man in North Hollywood. Our next service, because of the holiday schedule, is actually December 18th, and our theme is our quest for the many faces of love. Because after all, how many of us are tired of hearing how we're supposed to live, what our God is supposed to look like and be about, what we can and cannot do with our bodies, how we're supposed to worship, who we can and cannot love and marry, that goddess is a demon and her spirituality isn't real or deserving of equality and protection, that caring for one another and perpetuating ideals of caring, peace, balance, fairness, equality, and partnership, well, those are somehow a bad thing. Well, that's the whole point of Sacred Sundays, to gather together with like-minded men and women who want to create a new paradigm, a new future, one that works for us all in this delicious stew of diversity that is the divine feminine and sacred masculine. So we hope you'll consider joining us monthly and be the change we want to see in the world to help us set a tone that ushers in a new world that rebirths the ideals of goddess at the center of society. And Sacred Sundays, like I said, they're back at the Green Man in North Hollywood, and our next service is December 18th. So carve out some sacred space for yourself, connect with community, enjoy singing, sharing, wisdom telling. So that's at the Green Man. I'd also like to thank Jeanette Clancy for sending me excerpts from the Declaration of Interdependence by the 99%, because it's important, and I'd like to share it with you. So let me read just this short blurb. Again, the Declaration of Interdependence by the 99%. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for the citizens of a nation to petition their own government for a redress of grievances, the people have a duty to exercise their rights under the First Amendment collectively if they so choose. And we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal, regardless of their financial status, that we no longer are represented by our government, that the limits of power of the federal government have been deliberately and repeatedly breached, that our government has become destructive toward the vast majority of the same people that they are supposed to protect, that outside influences have gained unreasonable power and influence within our government, that the fair election system is being systematically dismantled. By the 1%, we mean specifically those from an aristocracy who manipulate government, and we define the 99% as the common citizen. Again, those are just some excerpts from the Declaration of Interdependence by the 99% that's out there trying to occupy everything and fight for our democracy. And I want to thank Jeanette Clancy for sending that in. Jeanette is a regular contributor to Voices of the Sacred Feminine and to my Facebook page, and she has a wonderful blog of her own called God Is Not Three Guys. GodIsNotThreeGuys.com. GodIsNotThreeGuys.com. That's also the name of her book, and you can find her in the archives. She is a wonderful progressive Christian who I've interviewed on the show, and I have the utmost respect for. Also, I want to thank Morgan for sending in some comments, and I'd like to share those with you. She says, I want to thank you for performing our wedding ceremony. You were absolutely amazing, and everyone was so moved by your words. And also, thank you for inviting us to Sacred Sundays. You, Samantha, and Marcia are very special, inspiring, and positive people that everyone can learn a thing or two from. Every time I leave Sacred Sundays, it really does give me a lot to think about, and it changes the way I think about myself and others. So thank you. Well, thank you, Morgan, for sharing that. And it's nice to know that what we're doing out there is making a difference. And Bernice Foster, she also sent in some comments that I'd like to share with listeners. She said, ooh, your show gave me such a thrill and such hope. I was utterly determined to set aside time tonight to listen to you, and I'm so glad I did. I'm energized and reminded what amazing, spiritual, strong warrior women there are out there in the world. My cup was running dry, and now I'm smiling and energized again. Onward. And that was from Bernice. Thank you, Bernice. And I'd like you to stay tuned throughout tonight's broadcast, because I want to tell you about China's Leftover Women and our guest lineup for December. So that's more exciting news. And by the way, did you happen to miss some of the past shows? Just in case you did, you can check the archives and catch some of these. Last week, I had Lamont Wood on the show. He's the author of Out of Place and Time and Space, talking about artifacts discovered that defy traditional history. Philip Copens, the editor of Eric von Daniken's new book, Odyssey of the Gods, we chatted about that. Professor Candace Kant on the anthology that's out on the exaltation of the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet. Vicki Garrison was on the show, and we talked about the dangers of the Quiverful movement. Well, that's sort of a subset of the evangelical dominionist Christianity movement that's so dangerous to women these days. Bernard Kastrup, author of Dreamed Up Reality, we talked about rational ground for the spiritual and the mystical. Vicki Alvier Schechter, she has a fiction book out about Cleopatra's daughter, and also the demonization of powerful women in contemporary society, just as Cleopatra the VII was demonized herself, so things have not changed that much. And Mary Mackey, well, she spoke to us about recreating the rituals of goddess, and how the book that she wrote, which had so many rituals in it, was actually inspired by the writings of Maria Gimbutas. So please catch any of these shows from the archives anytime if you can't call in live. And remember to listen at 6 p.m. Pacific. You can always catch this show or any other show later from the archives at your convenience. And you can listen via iTunes as well. And if you can't listen live but have questions, you can always email your questions several days before showtime. So thank you for your input and feedback. Comments are always welcome. And like I like to say, they're gas in my tank. Now, I have been stalling a little bit here, to tell you the truth, because Reverend Billy has not called in yet. He was supposed to call in a few minutes before we went live, and he has not. We spoke yesterday, so I know he knows about the show. So I'm going to have to shift gears here a little bit, and maybe what I'll do is, as I give him a little bit more time to realize he's late and call in, I'll go ahead and talk to you about China's Leftover Women, because my second caller, well, she's not scheduled to call in for a few minutes yet. Anyway, this article, China's Leftover Women, it was really pretty disturbing. It comes from a website called care2.com. Some of you may know it if you read my my Facebook page. You will actually see postings there from care2.com on occasion. But hang on one second. Before we do that, Reverend Billy might actually be there on the switchboard. So let me take a chance and see if that's him, and we'll save China's leftover women for the end of the show when I intended to actually share it with you. So let me go check here and see if that's him. Reverend Billy, is that you?
No, I called to listen in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're waiting for Reverend Billy right now, so
okay.
I'm going to go ahead and, unless you have a question for me, or you were just listening, sir.
Oh, actually, I just called, so I'm not sure what you were talking about previously, so I'll just take one to listen. Thank you, though.
All right. Thank you. I'll go ahead
welcome.
And mute you. Thank you for being a listener. Okay, so getting back to China's leftover women, this article from the website care2.com, it was written by Letta Hong Fincher of Ms. Magazine, and it goes like this. It's really incredible. Last week, 26-year-old newlywed college graduate Li Feng, a pseudonym, it explained to me over dinner why she had been in such a hurry to marry. She says, if I hadn't gotten married now, I would still have to date for at least 1 or 2 years. Then I would already have passed the best childbearing age, and I would be a leftover woman. Well, in China, the sexist term leftover woman, or sheng nu, is widely used to describe an urban professional female over the age of 27 who's still single. This derogatory term has been aggressively disseminated by the Chinese government, warning women that they will become spinsters if they do not marry by the time they turn 30. The irony of the media campaign is that Chinese sex ratio imbalance has resulted in a surplus of tens of millions of men who will not be able to find a bride, but yet they have nerve to say, you know, these older women are somehow undesirable, I guess. Well, in 2007, China's Ministry of Education added the term leftover woman to its official lexicon, according to state media reports. And in 2010, the All China Women's Federation and other government groups carried out a nationwide survey of more than 30,000 women in 31 provinces, and their findings on leftover women have been publicized repeatedly by China's official media. I have roughly translated some excerpts from the official write-up of the survey, unfortunately leaving out the rich resonance of Chinese puns. And this is what it says. The article uses the heading, "See what category of leftover you belong to." The first category is leftover women aged 25 to 27 years, are called leftover fighters, or Shang Dao Shi, a play on the title of a popular martial arts film. It says these women still have the courage to fight for a partner, so they're the leftover fighters. The next category is age 28 to 30-year-old women, or the ones who must triumph, or Bi Shang Ki, a play on the Chinese name for Pizza Hut. It says these women have limited opportunities for romance because their careers leave them with no time for the hunt. This is crazy, isn't it? The final category, 35 and older, is called the master class of leftover women. The term Qi Xiang Da Sheng plays on the name of an ancient Chinese legend, the Monkey King. It says this category of woman has a luxury apartment, private car, and a company, so why did she become a leftover woman? Results from the survey continue to be recycled frequently in the Chinese media, including this report on the official news website titled November 11th, China's Leftover Women Unite This Singles Day. The article says more than 90% of men surveyed said women should marry before 27 to avoid becoming unwanted. The message to women? If you want to stand a snowball's chance in hell of ever getting married in this country, don't demand too much from your man. Well, what I find uniquely disturbing, says the writer of the article, is that a respected American newspaper has regurgitated the results of the leftover woman survey without questioning the sexist nature of the term, the origins of the study, or the motivations of the government in disseminating it. The New York Times published an article in April based on the results of the Chinese survey, describing China's real estate boom and the pressure on men in China to buy a home in order to find a bride. It says that more than 70% of single women in a recent survey said they would tie the knot only with a prospective husband who owned a home, and provides a helpful link to the Chinese survey, but makes no mention about the survey's extensive descriptions of leftover women. Rather, the Times details how Chinese women will stop at nothing to coerce a man to give her a home before she agrees to marry. With such women on the prowl, even men who do have their own homes have come up with techniques to weed out the covetous and the inordinately materialistic. It adds that because of China's sex ratio imbalance, as many as 24 million men could be perpetual bachelors by 2020. The marriage competition is fierce, and statistically, women hold the cards. China's preference for boys, combined with its one-child policy, has resulted in the abortion of tens of millions of female fetuses. But does the resulting sex ratio imbalance mean that women really have the upper hand in the marriage market? Although some women no doubt have married for money, I have so far found very little evidence that women overall have turned their scarcity into economic gain. On the contrary, my research suggests that Chinese women have largely missed out on what is arguably the biggest accumulation of real estate wealth in history, valued at more than $17 million in 2010. Many women have been shut out of the explosion of housing wealth because homes appreciating exponentially in value tend to be registered solely in the man's name. Chinese parents tend to buy homes for sons but not daughters, and women who transfer all of their financial assets to their husband or boyfriend to finance the purchase of a home, it ends up being registered in the name of the man only. Well, ladies, and our like-minded brothers, what do you think of that? Not too good, eh? Well, Reverend Billy still has not called in. I'm a little bit concerned, but I'm gonna keep moving forward here. What I was gonna talk about with Reverend Billy was the film or documentary that he was involved with called "What Would Jesus Buy?" Fighting against the false idols of the Christian spirit. Well. And it was a very interesting documentary. It talked about how Reverend Billy and his activist group of performers who make up the Church of Stop Shopping. They're a performance activist group out there to save Christmas. They've been barred from places like Starbucks, Disneyland. They've been meeting a lot of resistance as they're going out into the world, into malls, telling people to stop shopping. You know, they bring to the fore the idea that Disney presides over sweatshops, and how we can't, here in the United States, our workers just can't compete with that slave labor. In the documentary, they talk about the shopping mall as a symbol of everything that's gone wrong with America. And he asks, how will the mall survive if the 99% loses this fight with the 1% and the middle class dies? He talks about Walmart. That was a big target of theirs in the documentary, What Would Jesus Buy? And he asks, you know, what's wrong with our mentality that we have everything so cheap? Because by requiring that everything be so cheap, well, you know, we actually can't, we can't pay higher wages in this country. And we have to ask ourselves, do we want low prices or do we want higher wages for our workers? Because he goes on to say with the, you know, why these prices in places like Walmart are so cheap. It's because workers are paid 7 cents an hour and work 20-hour shifts. The employees are beaten. Their kneecaps have been broken when they try to unionize. And here in the United States, us as consumers, well, you know, we're either cooperating or we're complicit in this slavery, you know, all to save maybe a buck or two on a pack of socks. Because what's really resulted in, you know, from this globalization is Americans are losing benefits, good pay, and their retirement because, you know, we can't compete with the prices that that end up being the final sticker price because the person who made the product isn't really literally no more than a slave. You know, what jumped out at me in the documentary was there was a CNN commentator who said that she enjoyed her diamond ring more than her husband. They said that people spend 5 hours shopping and 1 hour practicing any kind of spirituality each week. So that sort of tells us what our priorities are. That we can fit all of the kids across the globe from, you know, the entire world in all the many shopping centers that exist. And that Christmas creates 5 million tons of waste. Reverend Billy talks about in the documentary that we're consumers, not producers. And, and he goes into, well, what that means. But he believes that if we could change Christmas, that we could change the rest of the year. And I hope he still calls in before it's too late because I wanted him to elaborate on that. He talked about how togetherness is created around gift giving, that we've come to equate material goods with love, and happiness is just the next purchase away. And, you know, as I watched the documentary, I really wondered, can we change this mentality? Do we realize how sick our society is? You know, some countries have a law against advertising to kids under 12 years old, but of course not here. I wonder if there's any chance we could get something like that here in the United States. And I'm really wondering, you know, as he went cross country with this with his group on this bus tour that they showed filmed in What Would Jesus Buy, I wonder where he met the most resistance. And I'm still hoping we get to talk to him. But we'll keep pushing on here. If you go to his website, you can also see that he's very much into supporting the Occupy protests. But let's just sort of give this some thought ourselves. How should we be looking at Christmas? What ideas can we use to replace the consumerism? And how can we help ourselves? You know, when so much of society is so consumed with this way of life. Well, you know, Reverend Billy says that, we're hoping for a better way of life, that Christmas was meant to shake the world up, to do things differently, not be consumers. He says the birth of the Christ child was about teaching us peace, not about buying stuff. And there's also a psychologist that they talk to in the documentary, gives some examples of, you know, when you're out there at the mall, some questions you can ask yourself that, might help you pause for a minute and see if you really do need to make that next purchase. They say, you know, ask yourself some of these questions. Number one, why am I here shopping? How will I pay for this stuff? So why am I shopping? How will I pay for this stuff? Where will I put it? I mean, you've seen those hoarding shows. Where will I put it? And even if you're not a hoarder, so many of us, we probably have so much stuff, we just don't even have any room to put it anymore. And do I need it? You know, do I really need this? And what would happen if I wait to buy it? You know, can I wait? Do I need to buy it right now? Well, anyway, those are some of the things that, they suggest in the documentary that, people do to try to help themselves overcome consumerism. I have somebody else showing up on the switchboard here. Let's see if that's Reverend Billy now. Reverend Billy, is that you?
Hi, Karen. No, this is Gina Messina Dysart. How are you?
Oh, Gina, I'm so glad you called early.
Listening in on your show, and I saw that. Well, I was listening that Reverend Brindley hadn't called in yet, and I thought I would call in because I have lots to say about the topic you're talking about. And
well, good.
We were scheduled to chat anyways.
Absolutely. You know what? You're a lifesaver. I love you. Thank you so much. I'm not sure where he is. You know, we talked yesterday. But, one of the things that, they talked about in the documentary is, you know, how can we shift away from this idea of, you know, gift giving is the thing that is going to create happiness, that, you know, the only reason we're together is because we're around the Christmas tree opening gifts. You know, why are we not giving of our time, you know, in things that really count? And, you know, I'd love to hear what you have to say on the topic.
Sure, sure. You know, I think this is such an important topic. I am a new parent of a toddler, and my husband and I have been spending a lot of time talking about what is Christmas going to be like, because we don't want to start off a tradition that's focused on consumerism. You know, we don't want to start off this tradition focused on how many toys are you going to get for Christmas. We want it to be a special holiday that is focused on family and what is important, but also want her to experience some of the excitement that we remember when we were children, which, of course, was such a very different time than it is today. So we've really been working through those issues and trying to figure out what a good balance is. But I also I wanted to comment because you were talking about Walmart. And who doesn't have an opinion about Walmart, really, right? But I am from Cleveland, and so in Ohio, we have really felt the wrath of Walmart. You know, where we had large companies that were, you know, employing lots of people in local areas that had to shut down as a result of Walmart's opening up in the area. And it's been a very, very painful process for people in my hometown. So hearing what you were talking about, you know, the idea is that people are really demanding these lower prices, but not really recognizing the kind of damage that it's causing, I think it's easy to miss when you're not directly affected by it in your community. But so many communities are being affected by this, especially now that we've had this huge, huge issue with the economy, that I'm hoping that more and more people are recognizing that Walmart is not the place to be shopping, because we're really, really hurting ourselves by doing that. You're
not only saving money
in the long run.
Well, yeah, I mean, because we're saving a few bucks, maybe we can buy more stuff that we don't really necessarily need because it's a little bit cheaper. But, yeah, in the long run, we are hurting ourselves because, you know, like they bring out in the documentary, you know, the price we are really paying to get those cheap prices is corporations are not using American workers anymore. You know, they're using the slave labor in, you know, places like Sri Lanka or China. And, you know, American consumers have no idea the suffering that these people go through to, you know, to provide these products, and you know, so we have to really look at the big picture.
Sure. And what's surprising to a lot of people is that Walmart doesn't really offer the low, low prices that we are all almost duped into believing exist. They do specialized marketing tactics that lead people to believe that they have the lowest prices over everybody else, when in actuality they have a couple of items that are priced to sell, and everything else in the store is priced very similar to other stores as well. So it's almost it's very, very creative marketing on Walmart's part, and people are led to believe that, you know, if I go shop at Walmart, I'm going to save myself, you know, $50 this month or $100 this month so that I can put in my gas tank, when in actuality, the prices are really not that big of a difference.
Yeah, and when you think of the cost, because wasn't it just Walmart that, you know, the lawsuit went all the way to the Supreme Court because they were discriminating against women? And, you know, not only that, but I've read that, you know, and I don't know about this firsthand, but I've read on the Internet that they will work people, say, 36 or 38 hours, just shy of that 40-hour mark, so that they don't have to pay them any benefits. I think they can consider them part-time if they, you know, don't work them a full 40-hour week. So, you know, those couple hours cost the people, you know, benefits that they need. And so it's a despicable employment practices, really, when you think about it.
Well, absolutely. There are huge, huge issues with Walmart being, you know, a violator of employee rights, of worker rights, and that they refuse to unionize. They refuse to offer benefits. And people are really suffering, and they're kind of stuck in a cycle who are working at Walmart, that they work there, they spend their money there, and they're stuck in this cycle because Walmart doesn't offer the kind of benefits or the union representation to their employees that other companies do. And this is a huge problem with Walmart, amongst many other things. I think a great documentary, I have not seen Reverend Billy's documentary, but I have seen the documentary called Is Walmart Good for America? It's a Frontline video, and it's a terrific film. And I would encourage anybody to see it and really think about whether or not they want to go spend their money in a store that really is a huge violator of worker rights and really, really taking advantage of people in a time of need. I feel very strongly about the issue.
I do too, Gina. And, you know, and I'll admit, you know, I occasionally go in Walmart. You know, I mean, I have not banned them. But, you know, I really think, you know, we all have to raise our consciousness and, you know, think about, you know, where we're spending our money. And I think, honestly, I probably should have not been going to Walmart anymore, but that's going to be one of my resolutions for the new year, you know, no more Walmart. In fact, you know, I think what we really need to do as consumers, and maybe there's even such a list on the Internet, I'm going to have to take the time to look, but look at who these multinational corporations are that have outsourced American jobs to these third world countries who are using slave labor, who sell stuff back to us. And, you know, we all should just boycott these stores. I know they mentioned Disney, they mentioned Starbucks in Reverend Billy's documentary, but I'm sure there must be more. And I know one of the reasons that he said that he started all of this was because in his hometown, he saw all of these mom-and-pop stores going out of business because Walmart comes to town. And,
sure.
You know, people who had businesses all their lives, suddenly, everybody's excited because they think Walmart's going to bring in jobs. But like you said, they end up in this, trapped in this cycle of low-paying jobs with no benefits. And they're not really that much better off.
Right, absolutely. My family has banned Walmart. I'm proud to say, and neither me or my husband has stepped foot in a Walmart. I mean, in more than a decade, I would have to think, as we really started to become aware of the issues that are involved. And I would encourage anybody to take their business elsewhere and not
Absolutely.
Support that system. So I think that's a great New Year's resolution on your part.
Well, you know, and I don't know if I don't know how prevalent Walmart is around the globe, but, you know, I can't help but remember when Roy and I were in Paris and we would walk down the street and you still had all of these small little shops. You had the butcher shop, you had the bakery, you had the seafood provider. You know, you had the little tiny grocery store that's not like a big huge market. You know, you had all of these family businesses walking down the street. In fact, it was so obvious, you know, what people seemed to do. They would get off the subway and they would hit these little shops on the way home, going in one door and out the other, you know, and getting all the things they needed to prepare dinner. And, you know, you didn't see Walmart in Paris. You know, you still saw family businesses supporting themselves, supporting the community. And you know what? That seems a lot healthier.
Right. I absolutely agree with you. You're absolutely correct.
Well, you know, Gina, maybe we've exhausted this topic for now, and it doesn't look like Reverend Billy's going to call in at this point. I'm not sure what happened. I'll have to reschedule him because I know he was definitely excited about doing the show. So I'll get him on another time. But let's go ahead and jump into what you and I were going to talk about to begin with. Let me start, reading your bio for listeners so they can get to know you a little bit, and then we'll start chatting about what did you call it, the F word in religion, and the Feminism in Religion Project in your forthcoming book, Rape Culture and Spiritual Violence. So listeners, this is who Gina Messina Dysart is. She is the visiting assistant professor of theological ethics at Loyola Marymount University. That's here in Southern California. She's also the co-founder and co-director of the Cutting Edge Feminism and Religion Project, which explores the F word in religion, and the intersection between scholarship, activism, and community. In addition, she's the founder and director of Femme Theologian, a social justice project sponsored by Joke Productions that seeks to offer the latest news and progressive thinking related to feminist theology and women's issues in a global context. Gina earned her doctorate degree at Claremont Graduate University with a dual focus in women's studies in religion and theology, ethics, and culture, and completed a Master of Business Administration with a dual focus in organizational leadership and marketing at the University of Findlay near her hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. Gina also earned a Master of Arts in Religious Studies at John Carroll University and completed her undergraduate degree at Cleveland State University. As the author of multiple articles in the forthcoming book, Rape Culture and Spiritual Violence, Gina has given serious attention to issues faced by women in relation to religion and social justice. Her research interests are theologically and ethically driven, involve a feminist and interdisciplinary approach, and are influenced by her activist roots and experience working with survivors of rape and domestic violence. Wow, Gina, you've been busy. You've been really busy. And husband and new daughter, too. So now you've added that to your plate.
Yes, yes. Life is good. Life is full and very good.
Yes, Goddess has given you lots of abundance. So let's start with the FAR project, the Feminism and Religion Project. Tell us about that.
Okay, great. Well, first, I want to say thank you so much for inviting me on to talk with you. It's really a pleasure to be on your show and to know you and to know the work that you're doing. So I appreciate this opportunity. And the Feminism and Religion Project is a very exciting project that was founded fairly recently, just over the summer. And it is a blogging project that really focuses to bring different voices together from around the world, from different religious traditions, different cultural backgrounds, to talk about different issues that face women in religion in today's society. So we're really focusing on issues in a 21st century context on this site. And with our very recent start, we've been fortunate that we've gotten a lot of attention, and the site has really blown up, if you will. And we have subscribers from every continent around the world, people who are, you know, signing on to read these different articles that are being posted daily by all kinds of women and men, like I said, from different religious traditions, different cultural backgrounds, different social occasions in life that are talking about these issues. And so we have these people, you know, people signing in from all over to read these articles, to comment on them. And what's happening is that we are seeing, you know, people from all over coming together, commenting and having dialogue about these different issues and learning from one another. And it's very, very exciting.
It sounds like it. I mean, so it's sort of this hub where everybody sort of, you know, it's almost like Facebook for feminism and religion in a way. Everybody can come and take part. And I mean, I know I've gone there when I was interested in feminism and Kabbalah, for instance. I found it, you know, very helpful to see what some of the feminists were saying about Kabbalah. And I believe when we spoke recently, you've sort of managed a coup, didn't you, with some information that about Mary Daly that hadn't been out for a while? You have there on your blog?
Oh, right. Yes, yes. We have this, you know, I mean, a very, very amazing thing had occurred. We actually had a person write an article about you know, some history that had taken place between Audre Lorde and Mary Daly. And the person had written about the fact that Audre Lorde had published, you know, a public letter to Mary Daly that she had stated Mary Daly had never responded to her on. And that has been the common knowledge on that issue for all these years. This had happened, you know, back in the 70s. And if you Google, you know, the letter, letter from Audre Lorde to Mary Daly, this letter from Audre Lorde would pop up. And if you Googled Mary Daly's letter to Audre Lorde, the same thing would pop up. There was no other information out there. Well, when we had this article published, Carol Crist reached out to me, who also is a regular contributor on this site. She writes several times a month for us. And she reached out to me and she said, you know, Gina, this information is incorrect. And Mary Daly did write a letter to Audre Lorde. And as a matter of fact, I have a copy of the letter. She sent it to me. And it was something that Mary Daly had really struggled with, that this information wasn't out there. And she had asked Carol to help her get that information out in the open. So she scanned it and sent it to me. And I was able to, write some information about this, you know, historical happening between Audre Lorde and Mary Daly, and offer this letter that was written by Mary Daly to Audre Lorde that many people had not heard of before. Mary Daly actually had written about it in one of her books. She had written about it in her book, Amazon Grace. And that was one of the areas that it had existed. But what we were able to post on the site was the original document itself, a scanned copy of the original document itself, along with, you know, a transcript of that. And now if you Google Mary Daly's letter to Audre Lorde, there's something out there that demonstrates, yes, this letter did exist. Mary Daly did respond. And it was really clearing up a misunderstanding in history. So it felt very, very important that we have this happen on the site.
Well, and it's so much fun to see the letter because it was back in the days when we actually used typewriters, and you could tell,
right.
You know, it's, you know, funny in a way like that, isn't it? I mean, it really, the seeing the letter visually, it just sort of brings you back to that time. It was lots
exactly.
of fun.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, now, it's a really amazing letter. It's a really amazing document to look at. And it even has, because it was faxed to Carol Crist, so it has the fax number across the top, even that, which is fairly more recent to us, right? But something
right.
that we really don't utilize as much anymore. But a very, very interesting to look at that document.
Right, right. Well, now, so Carol Crist has written for the project. Any other names we'd recognize that, you know, we can go to the site and see what they're thinking about and pondering these days?
Absolutely. We have some very exciting people writing for the site. We just had an article go up today by Kwok Pwilan, and Rosemary Radford Ruther is a regular person who writes for our site. She's endorsed the site. She endorsed it early on and has given us several articles, which is really terrific. Karen Torgeson, who is the chair of the Women's Studies and Religion Graduate Program at Claremont Graduate University, has also written for us. Charlene Sprutnak, Peggy Reeves Sanday, Starhawk has written for us, and the list goes on. So some very, very recognizable names for people who are familiar with the field of feminism and religion. And so what we're doing here, what's really exciting, is that we have these foremothers, if you will, chiming in and talking about what's happening, you know, in today's society with this particular field. And then we have, you know, the up-and-coming generation of feminist scholars in religion writing and talking about these issues. And so we're really expanding borders across generations. And I often say I feel like it's, you know, the foremothers are almost like passing the torch on this site. They're offering mentorship and wisdom and guidance. And here these up-and-coming scholars are talking about, you know, these new ideas in the 21st century that really haven't been addressed before. And that's very, very exciting, and it makes the site very dynamic. So it's a very, very good mix, you know, of these different perspectives that are coming in, and people seem to really be getting a lot out of it.
Well, you know, I like that you said, you know, that it explores the F word in religion, because obviously you're referring to feminism. But by the same token, you know, feminism has gotten such a bad rap. You know, unfortunately, it has this derogatory, you know, connotation in the uninformed circles. And would you say this is a site that someone could go to, and you know, those sorts of uninformed ideas might be dispelled?
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you go to the site, it's if I can just mention the web address, it's,
sure,
it's easy. It's feminismandreligion.com. And if you go to the site, we have, you know, our front page that offers article after article, our home page, and then we have tabs, and we have an About tab that talks a little bit about our project and what we're doing. It has a video with some of the contributors and co-founders talking about the project. And then we have a tab called What is Feminism? And this was so important to have this on this project because, first of all, as you mentioned, the word itself has such a negative connotation for people. It's been associated with very negative things, and of course that's not what feminism is about in the least. And the other issue is that people have so many different definitions of feminism. How should we define it? How should we talk about it? And so that's something we really wanted to be able to explain on this site. How are we focusing on feminism on this site, and how are we, you know, defining this as we are incorporating it into these articles and discussions. And so Rosemary Radford Ruther actually gave us this terrific article that she had written about what is feminism, and that's what we have posted there. And from her definition, which is really our focus on the site, she talks about feminism being the full recognition, the recognition of the full humanity of every person, both men and women. And I really feel like, what a terrific definition. What a great way to explain this, you know, that we're talking about the full human dignity of every single person. And that's what feminism is all about, if you want to put it in a nutshell. I think that's a great way to say it. So we were ever so grateful that Rosemary offered us the opportunity to share that article here on our site. And also, you know, I feel like that's really how we should be talking about feminism.
Absolutely. Well, and when you think about it, it's absurd, isn't it, when you think about how the spin doctors have demonized the word. I mean, you still have, who is it, Jerry Falwell, is it? Or, you know, I forget, is he the one that passed away or not? I sort of get those, you know, 700 Club guys mixed up. But I know they said, you know, feminism, you know, would lead to lesbianism, and it was, you know, going to destroy the family. And, I mean, all of this negative stuff that has no basis in fact. And, you know, really, you know, all women are looking for is equality. I mean, would the fabric of society unravel if women wanted to just be equal? You know, it's kind of crazy when you think of it, that the spin could be put on this in such a way that, you know, women want an equality could turn into such, you know, a despicable or an undesirable thing. It's hard to even imagine, quite frankly.
Sure, sure. Well, I think that it's really intimidating for people who are comfortable with the culture. The culture that we have, you know, we talk about patriarchal culture. It's uncomfortable for people to think about breaking away from that because it's something we've become, you know, so comfortable with. And not everybody is comfortable with it, but many people are. Many people don't see what the issues are with our modern-day society. Many feel like, you know, the women's liberation movement has happened. We've moved on. Things are great. Why are people complaining? And that's really not the case. You know, if we look at statistics show that women still make 70 cents on the dollar to men.
Right.
Which is really shocking here in the 21st century.
Well, and the other statistic is I think only there's only 17% of women in leadership in not just academia and corporate America, but also government. And when you only have, you know, less than 20% of women with their voice in the decision making, then, you know, it's still a good old boys club. And this idea of that women have made such strides, well, you know, they haven't made such strides. There's still a long way to go.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think that that's the important point. I think that women are making strides. We have made huge strides, but there is a long way to go. And something that Rosemary Radford Ruther always says is, you know, 2,000 years of oppression is not going to be undone, you know, in a couple of decades. And
right.
That's something we really need to recognize.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think that's such an important point. And I think it's interesting, you mentioned equality, you know, women really wanting equality. And I think that sometimes that can be a little bit of a dangerous word, because what is equality and what does that mean for each person? I think that that's an important question. And so I often try to avoid that kind of language, and that's one of the reasons that I really like Rosemary's definition about affirming the full human dignity of every person, because I think that that's something that we can relate to everyone and not have to worry about people having different definitions. But that's just something that I struggle with that I wanted to throw out there.
But I think that's a good point, though, Gina. And it reminds me of a recent interview I had with a woman from that evangelical dominionist part of the Christian movement. She had escaped the Quiverful movement, and you know she was telling me about the horrendous things that women go through when they're in the Quiverful movement. But by the same token, so many women still flock to it. And what she said was, I thought a lot of what she said was revealing, and I'll just make a couple points because I think it's sort of the, you know, the opposite end maybe of the spectrum from what we're talking about. I mean, she said stuff like she thought that some of the women got involved with the Quiverful movement because they really did want to abdicate responsibility. They didn't want to compete out there in the world. They just wanted the husband to sort of take care of things. So I can see where the idea of equality would be really a scary thing to maybe those women, you know, because the woman who had escaped the Quiverful movement explained to me that she got caught up in it because it felt like the world was so big. There were so many options out there, and it just scared her to death. It felt so much safer to just be in this small little box and not have those pressures of options in the outside world, and you know, it was easier to just be in the home and take care of the things that you know, were deemed her role, you know, and so anyway, I find that interesting because I guess what I'm saying is I'm sure these women felt like, you know, they had their dignity. And maybe for them equality was a little bit, you know, or who knows, you know, I'm assuming here, but they might not even have felt they didn't have equality. I don't know. It's sort of a complicated thing to understand, but I find it really interesting.
Sure, sure. Well, I think that that actually really goes back to the idea of the struggle within patriarchal culture and how women can often play a role in continuing on that culture, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I often talk about the fact that, you know, obviously my grandmother's generation is a very different generation than my generation, and it's always been a question for her on why am I working and not being a stay-at-home mother, right? For her, this is a problem. For me, it is not. And I think that's because that generation, it's very, very easy to play into the culture. And I think there are still you know, many women who do play into the patriarchal culture. Not that it's problematic to be a stay-at-home parent. It certainly
right.
is not. But it is also not problematic for women to have careers and to make other decisions in their lives. And that's you know, important to recognize. And so, you know, having women support each other and support a movement that, you know, works towards ending oppression of women is really crucial, and that doesn't always happen.
Again, I'm glad you punctuated that. You know, it's not that we're saying anything wrong with women who decide to just stay home if that's what they want to do, as long as if that was their decision and they're not told that that is their role in life. You know, that there are no other options. You know, I think that's maybe the key in this. Would you say that it's, you know, their choice as opposed to what some church doctrine tells them, you know, they're supposed to be. You know, I think I have a problem with it when they start to say, well, you know, I know we're getting a little off topic here and we'll get back on track. But, you know, when the women are supposed to be submissive to their husband and do what the husband tells them and, you know, live this life that they can't really achieve their full potential. And at least to me, that would almost play into, you know, are they attaining their full human dignity? Even, you know, maybe we don't call it equality, but can they be achieving their full human dignity? Certainly not their fullest potential. I don't know. It's certainly not an idea that we're going to settle tonight. But it's nice to talk about it and hear your views on it because this is your forte.
Sure. No, I mean it's a really crucial issue. It certainly is, and you know, certainly you know, oppression against women exists, you know, in all structures, including you know, church structures, right? And this is a serious issue, and so you know, the full human dignity of women, you know, is not being recognized. When we have situations or structures that are creating oppression. And so that's a very serious issue.
Right. Well, so let's go back to the Feminism and Religion Project more specifically. How can those who are interested, you know, maybe get involved with the project?
Well, sure. That's a terrific question. You know, first of all, we have this terrific site. You should definitely go to the site, check it out. We have a button on the site for you to subscribe. So if you subscribe to the site, you will get an email update every time a new post goes up, which is daily. We generally have posts going up 7 days a week, so it'll notify you of the post, so you can remember to check in and read it. We also have a Facebook page, which you can like us on Facebook, and it kind of gives you the updates as new posts go up. We have a Twitter account as well, and so if you're on Twitter, please follow us on Twitter. We'll follow you back, and that also will tweet out every time we have new articles or new information going up. So those are all different ways to be connected with feminism and religion, but also, you know, signing on, read the articles and then share your thoughts, share your comments. I mean, this is really where community is being created on this site, is that we have people from all over the world, again, with varying perspectives, you know, from different traditions and different cultures and so on and so forth, coming on and sharing their thoughts about these different topics people are writing about. And what happens is there ends up being a great dialogue amongst these people that might not otherwise take place. You know, with the blog, what's so exciting about it is it really breaks down hierarchy. You don't have hierarchy in the way that you have in other situations. Reader becomes the writer and the writer becomes the reader. So, you know, people are able to share their thoughts and have an open dialogue. And also, geographical situations are no longer an issue. So it doesn't matter where you're at in the world, you can have conversations with people anywhere. And that is really, really super exciting. And so by being able to have those dialogues, again, we're really expanding borders, and it's really terrific. So, you know, sign on. Share your thoughts and comments. Your thoughts and comments are important, and people need to hear them. So that is really, really crucial. And
well,
also,
now, or do people make contributions besides essay form? I mean, you know, what sort of contributions do your, you know, do the writers make to the blog?
Sure, exactly. So we have, you know, different people from the field of feminism and religion writing daily. They're writing articles daily. And they're fairly, you know, I say, you know, short articles in that they're 1,000 words or less. So it's not an overwhelming read. You know, it's something that you can log on and read kind of quickly and formulate your thoughts and opinions about and then share them. But we're also really open to having submissions to the site. I mean, if you are interested in the site, if you are interested in the content on the site and you would like to write an article about something that you feel is important, please submit that to us, and we will talk with you about, you know, getting it up on the site. That's really important, as we want this to be a platform for every voice, not just for some voices. This is not just a forum for, you know, academic scholars. This is a forum for everyone. So a very, very important part of our mission is to bring together voices, you know, from, yes, academia. We do have people blogging here from academia, but also from, you know, people who are involved in activism and people who are involved in the greater community. So this is not just about academia. It's about the greater community and everybody having a voice.
I really like that, because I feel like that's one of the things I do hear with Voices of the Sacred Feminine. It's sort of a you know, sort of a meeting point where not just scholars but also activists, visionaries, you know, people who are doing things in the community but maybe they don't have a PhD behind their name, but, you know, they're all working toward that common goal, because, you know, they're all threads of the tapestry. And and then together, you know, with everybody's voice, you have a much richer, I think, you know, end results, so to speak, you know, because you're having people from different perspectives, you know, come together on these topics. So you see things, you know, see things outside of just that academic lens. So Gina, so what, you know, you're also the director of Femme Theologian. What is that?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's a great question, because it's a project that's still kind of getting off the ground. We're just in our very, very beginning stages with this particular project. And what it is it's a site that is really dedicated to focusing on social injustice against women. So whereas feminism and religion is, you know, offering discussions, you know, under this broad umbrella topic, Femme Theologian is more focused on social injustice and, you know, human rights violations for women. So with this particular site, we're looking to do a couple of different things. First of all, certainly to be putting out articles about different things that are happening, you know, today around the world that are affecting women. And what are some different ways that we can work towards, you know, eradicating this violence? So that's a very, very important focus. In addition, we're also developing podcasts here to put out through this site. And so interviewing, you know, different women and men that are focused on, you know, eradicating social injustice against women, talking about the issues that are out there and talking about how we all can get involved and focus on making an impact. So those are some of the things that we're really focused on doing with this particular site.
So go ahead. Well, I was going to say, so I'm thinking, so Femme Theologian, that would be a place where women or men would talk about the fact that women can't be ordained, or they don't make equal pay for equal work, or sex sex trafficking. All of these different sorts of topics could potentially be on Femme Theologian.
Certainly. Certainly. That's exactly the type of thing that is being focused on in this particular project. That is exactly it.
So where the other one is a blog, this is more of a podcast where you're actually going to be interviewing people, and you will see the people being interviewed on your computer screen. Do I have that right?
Yes, yes. I mean, it will serve as both. There will be, you know, articles, blog style articles.
Okay.
That you can read, and there will also be podcasts, so you can actually watch an interview as a video. And the long-term goal is to hopefully produce some documentaries about some of the serious issues that women are facing around the world today in relation to social injustice and religion, in an effort to continue to spread the message and to raise awareness about these issues. And so that is the real hope. So with Femme Theologian, you know, this is a project that I have teamed up with this company, Joke Productions, to produce these podcasts and eventually produce these documentaries on these issues. And Joke Productions is, you know, a production company here in Los Angeles that has done some pretty exciting work in reality television. They've done a lot with reality television, but also, you know, documentaries as well. And so they just have a wonderful documentary that just played the film festival circuit and was also, you know, competing for an Academy Award, actually. And the film was called Dying to Do Letterman, a terrific, terrific film, highly, highly acclaimed, about a gentleman who's terminally ill, a stand-up comedian, and his goal to live out his dream of performing stand-up on the David Letterman show before he passes away. And so this documentary follows his journey, and it's been a really, really inspiring film. And so over the summer, I spent my summer working to help promote the film, and then we blossomed this project, Femme Theologian, from my work with them on this film.
Wow. Well, that sounds like that could be lots of fun. And, I mean, the topics are just endless out there that you could work on together.
Right. Absolutely. It's amazing. Almost anything can happen in Hollywood, right?
That's for sure. So, and, you know, I don't know how you find the time, especially now that you're also a new mom, but you also have a book coming, Rape Culture and Spiritual Violence. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, it's hopefully going to be released sometime next year. It's completed manuscript. It's with the publisher. And it is a book that really focuses on bringing together, you know, my background in the field of theology and the field of religion, along with my activist work that I have done with rape and domestic violence survivors. It was really important for me to create, you know, a project or create a manuscript that really explored these two backgrounds that have been so important in my life. And so that's what I really have done with this particular book. So what I did was I really examined rape culture in religion. You know,
define that. What does that mean?
That's such a great question. What is rape culture? And I think it's a term that generally can be uncomfortable for some, and also is something that people have not a good understanding of. And so rape culture really is a culture where violence against women is prominent. You know, the title is Rape Culture, so it has a strong focus on sexual violence within culture, but really applies to all types of violence against women. And so it's the idea that we live in a culture where violence against women is prevalent. It occurs daily. Women are constantly in being threatened with violence. And this is the culture that we live in. And this culture is being perpetuated, you know, within society on multiple levels, but also within the church. Certainly, we can talk about rape culture being perpetuated in religion. And so I think that that's something that often can feel uncomfortable for people to talk about. But there are huge issues here. And so in this book, what I'm really focused on is examining the different ways that religion, you know, perpetuates the culture and what can be done to change that.
Well, now, are you going beyond the pedophilia? I mean, are you talking about, I mean, who are you talking about is the rapist and who is the victim? Or is it, you know, is there a wide variety of, you know, a victim and, you know, the person committing the crime?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. So when we're talking about rape culture, we're not just talking about rapist and victim or rapist and survivor. Are you there? Karen?